This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 11th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we set aside to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, meets the CEO of Swiss Storage Supremo USM, Alexander Scherer, in Zurich.
High-quality product, you know, it's a high-precision product and it's Swiss-made and it's still going to be Swiss-made in the future. That's one of the key values of the brand right now.
We discuss the future of the Tempelhof Airport Park in Berlin.
People are really taking care of Tempelhof because everyone, you know, has freedom to do what he wants and there's no such restriction done by, like, well-minded planners.
And we pull open the doors and peer into Serbia's first ever R&D centre dedicated to design.
Our main aim is actually to help young designers develop their professional careers and also to try to provide a meeting point and a kind of matchmaking point for designers and representatives of companies or manufacturers.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To kick off this week's show, let's head to Switzerland. USM is a furniture brand known for efficient modular design, affording the owner the chance to combine, change and redesign should they wish. The company's simple, super sturdy shelving systems keeps homes and offices around the world well organised and good looking, not least here at Midori House. You'll find a sunshine yellow USM number in our waiting room. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, made the trip to Zurich to discuss the provenance of the USM brand with its CEO, Alexander Scherer.
The furniture was created like in the late 60s, early 70s. It wasn't so much emphasis on nationality, especially people like Fritz Haller or also my father. They didn't believe in these national states so much anymore. They rather created that furniture as a universal idea. You have to know that the furniture's heritage is this building system that was created by Fritz Haller, and that was truly seen more like a universal solution to build all over the world in the beginning, you know. And then, of course, the furniture was the offspring, so I don't think that at these times that was such a big theme. But over the years, of course, it has grown, I think, for two reasons. First of all, I think the product, in a way, lends itself to mass production. So that was one of the reasons why it was still possible to keep producing in Switzerland, because the production in the meantime has been highly automized for the parts production of the furniture, and we're still investing a lot in this process even now. So that was the reason why the production was never moved like to Romania, China, whatever here you name it. It wasn't so prominent then yet like in the last, let's say, decade, where values of sustainability and all these values in this field have become much more important. Also, like the social aspect of the production, you know, not to use any child labor or whatever to produce the product has become much more important. So now it's sort of part of the package, you know, that it's high quality product, you know, it's a high precision product and it's Swiss made, and it's still going to be Swiss made in the future. That's one of the key values of the brand right now.
When we look at the state of the marketplace right now, and you touched on the notion of social values, does this become a big distinguishing part for a lot of brands? Because you can flip through an interior design magazine, you might have all the money in the world, and you can buy one shelving system, you can buy one sofa system. Do you think the consumer today really thinks about the whole process and also what the final price is? When they think about that final price, do they think about, well, a lot of it is, yeah, the social cost of making something in Switzerland or Sweden or Germany still? Does that calculation come into it or not?
First of all, you have to distinguish between the home market, where people select their furniture for their home, It's definitely more important, I think, than in the corporate world, where sometimes just the bottom line price or discount is the driving force. So these are definitely two aspects. But I would think in the long run, you know, that is not sustainable. I think the product that can only, I mean, a physical product, like a piece of furniture, maybe with the exception of the watches, but a physical product can only be produced in Switzerland when really the automation of the production process is sort of pushed to a maximum, because otherwise you will just not be competitive at all, I would say. I think the beauty about the USM product, especially the shelving system, that it's in a way, it parts, they are really produced in high quantities, highly automated. But then actually the individual piece of furniture is still like a handmade, you know, system. It's put together mostly by people, you know. And that is sort of the nice thing about it. So now there, first of all, the cost associated to that process is not so important in the whole value chain of the product, first of all. And secondly, it's normally done in the market itself. So there it's a little bit buffered. Even in Germany, you know, we pay at least German salaries and not Swiss salaries when we put the furniture together. So that for sure makes a difference, yeah, because Switzerland is definitely the most expensive countries for production in the world.
When you look at the other side of the coin from the social aspects, there's sustainability. And I was just yesterday, I was visiting a new office building in Toronto, and you could see this company was in transition. So they'd moved in with their old furniture, and they were inheriting all of this new furniture. The old furniture, not that old, was 6 years old. You could see that nothing really matched. There was sort of no system, and you had this sort of company coming together, the merging of two parts. And it just struck me that, you know, a lot of stuff was already going out in the bin. It didn't quite fit. You could have all the certification, you know, that you want on something, but if it doesn't last, it's not that sustainable. So I'm wondering, when you look at the classic nature of your system, that you can obviously have pieces that you bought back in the 70s, back in the 80s, that you can still build from. Does this become part of your sustainability story as well?
Yeah, I think that's the basic idea of a furniture then that can or grow with its user, yeah? But because it's like a Lego system, it can grow. But it can also, I mean, the individual parts can also be transformed into different use. We know that in the office, the filing, it gets less and less, but maybe the creative part gets more important in an office. So you can get less filing units, but maybe a nice library space instead for the employees out of the same furniture. That's just an example. Or you can basically use it for any future use you could imagine. So it's not like you would buy a piece of furniture just for today, but you also buy the future of it with it. So that gives you much more possibilities than maybe with sort of like standard American, you know, cubicle systems where you just build the cubicles like for rabbits sometimes. And then, you know, after sometimes people, they really get bored of that and they will just throw it out of the window if they can, you know. So that's a bit the future of this kind of furniture, where else with our system, of course, you also have that sometimes people, you know, they don't see the value of it, but then at least they can sell it to quite a high price on on eBay or somewhere. But I mean, there's a lot of users, you know, they with the time they start to love it and to cherish it, and then, you know, they transform it, they use it for their home too, or vice versa, first at their home and then at their office. So they start playing with it and they start to find new use to it and so on. So of course that was in the basic idea in the 60s, you know, because also there we would think, when you look at the photos from my father's office at this time, it actually, even the funny part is, it almost looks more contemporary than a lot of the pictures of the current installations of USM, you know, more lean, maybe even less paper than we are used to now, still in the banks or whatever. The only thing that makes it maybe look old is, you know, the typewriter or the dictaphones that are on
the suit.
Even though the dictaphones, they were in orange then, they were quite nice. But then it just looks, you know, this looks old, but then the rest of the installation almost looks more lean, more contemporary, because the first office they did was for the own use at USM. And they would really just produce the minimum possible parts to equip the... It was really like a minimalistic installation in the beginning. And then, of course, in a way, the product, it got a bit more complex over the years, because with the customer needs, you also needed new features. So in a way, it got a bit more cumbersome. But then the beauty about this, you can still do it in a very, very lean way if you like. And I think that's also, I think, going to be a bit the future, you know, because with less filing, you know, you can have a nice, you know, very lean-looking sideboard with each workstation. So you will get back a bit that feel of when it started. Yeah.
Before we go, we'll do the game show part of the interview. I'm going to ask you a question. You just have to give me one or two-word answers.
Uh-huh. Great.
Favorite color in the system?
Well, right now it's the orange. Mm-hmm.
If you think of a material... desktop. I think we're looking at a very, very nice piece of matte walnut in front of us. What's your favorite tabletop system in the range?
For the working surface, it's the linoleum. Mm-hmm. Black linoleum, yeah. Just because it's nice to write on it.
Favorite city?
New York.
Favorite airline?
That's a difficult one. Last most favorite one maybe is still Swiss, but okay, with some reservations.
If USM was a car, what would it be?
Porsche, I think.
Favorite architect?
Fritz Haller.
Favorite city in Switzerland?
Zurich, I guess.
Tyler Brulé talking with USM CEO Alexander Scherer. As we all know, especially here on Section D, there are design festivals and there are design festivals, and each has its very own story to tell. But there can be few which tell the story of the city hosting them, as well as that of Kaohsiung in South Taiwan. The city was once one of the busiest ports in the world, but in recent years, its government has attempted to combat increased competition in the region with a completely new strategy, in order to make Kaohsiung known as a major creative capital of Asia. And the perfect demonstration of this has been the Design Festival, started in 2007 by the new Bureau of Cultural Affairs in their new home by the reclaimed harbour. It features warehouse after warehouse of new design thinking emerging in the city. Monocle's Chris Fitch made a visit to see exactly what progress they have made.
This warehouse also belongs to the Bureau of Cultural Affairs.
If you had decided 10 years ago to take a walk in the afternoon sunshine down to Pier 2 at Kaohsiung Harbour, you would have found it hard to believe that these abandoned warehouses from Japanese colonial rule nearly a century ago would today be home to an exciting and rapidly developing creative hub. It is with this context in mind that the annual Kaohsiung Design Festival becomes even more impressive, representing, as it does, the transformation which this old industrial city is experiencing.
I think it's interesting because previously in the southern part of Taiwan, they do not have much of a cultural landmark.
The theme for this year's festival is Cities Are More Than We Think. And curator of the main exhibition, Creative Cities, is Jackson Tan, creative director at Black Design in Singapore.
The goal of Creative Cities was to create a platform that coincides with the Asia Pacific's Creative City Summit that was hosted by Kaohsiung City Government. I thought that it would be interesting to create a platform that celebrates the creators from each different cities from Asia Pacific. And I wanted it to be like the Olympics as well as the APEC, where it grows through different cities and you can tour later on. It's not just a one-stop exhibition. So we invited 10 creative friends from each city. They became our city curator.
The exhibition attempts to map the design elements of the selected Asia-Pacific cities, namely Hong Kong, Tokyo, Beijing, Manila, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Singapore, Sydney, Seoul, and of course, Kaohsiung. Using keywords picked out from surveys conducted with resident creators, artists, designers, chefs, and more, each city becomes visualized into its own unique, vibrant illustration.
We invited 10 different illustrators from each city, and they drew their own mind map of their city. So this is the feature area where we, after we did all the survey, we have a summary of each city. So it's kind of like a city report. You basically walk into these square booth spaces, and the report tells you what the city's creative scene is about, who are the key people in there, what are the key products, and what are the key projects and the places. What I've learned from this experience is that the creative scene of the city and its development is very much centered on its people. So people is the greatest asset that brings value to the city. So you can see that how active and how innovative the creators are, that is the one that drives the creativity of the cities.
The exhibition also features a corridor where the walls are dotted with tiny speakers. Put your ear next to one and suddenly you're transported to a cultural hotspot in one of the cities featured.
So when you lean towards the wall, you can actually listen to things like, you know, a religious chanting in Japan, or the streets of Bangkok. Most of the difference is in the language that they speak, as well as the speed. Let's say, for example, the traffic light in Hong Kong is very fast. It's very fast. And Sydney is much more laid back.
And that's something which maybe people don't think about the city in a way. It's a design element, but it actually says a lot about what the city is.
Yeah, I mean, it defines the lifestyle and the speed and the way the people think in the city and the way they work and live.
Kaohsiung is in illustrious company in the Creative Cities exhibition, undoubtedly the cultural capitals of the Asia Pacific. The question Kaohsiung city government have to answer is, aside from hosting the festival, how they can justify their place on this list ahead of other cities, such as the Taiwanese capital, Taipei.
That is a very important and difficult question.
This is Jie Xi, director of the Kaohsiung Design Festival.
You know, the second largest city, Kaohsiung, we want to show more passion, more freedom, and more active in all kinds of things.
And this is not an attempted city rebrand which the government is forcing upon its citizens. This is a grassroots movement where the local cultural bureau is simply giving a leg up to the young local designers and artists who have embraced this world in recent years.
People in this city are willing to join the festival. That is a very important process, but we are not going to make an exhibition just for our willing, but not with the people in the city that want to join. It is a platform for young designer to show their creation or show their product, anything they want to show to the city.
Curator Jackson Tan agrees with this point of view.
The way that they position and promote the area is also very ground up, which is quite different from some of the creative cities, which are from top down, which are overplanned by the city sometimes. So I quite like the Kaohsiung development here.
The festival is also a shop window for a multitude of products and artworks, which primarily young people in South Taiwan have been creating. As Yongcheng Li, one of the staff at Pier 2, guides me past display after display of locally made products, from bioengineered food containers to purses to tape dispensers, it's clear that the festival is riding a wave of creativity within the city.
Kaohsiung started to change the industries. It's not only the heavy metal industry, it also could be design, and the design is not wasting the environment, it's saving the environment as well. This looks like the plastic boxes or the bottle, but it's all made by corns or carbons. They mix it together and become the new product. It's not plastic, but you can also recycle it. Can use it again and again.
The fact that so much of the work the festival is displaying comes from young residents of Kaohsiung suggests that the city has a bright future if it can utilize that talent and continue the progress it has started.
For young people or young designer to have more opportunity to change himself, I think that is the only thing and only way that we can do something in the future. And that is the spirit of this city.
But what does this mean for Kaohsiung internationally? Can the impressive thrust of support the city government is giving to the design sector genuinely make Kaohsiung a major player alongside those others in the Creative Cities exhibition?
Well, I think it's very interesting in terms of the context of Kaohsiung, because when I came here 5 years ago to work on an exhibition, the Pier 2 area had only like 5 warehouses that were open. There were not many people here at the time. But now, after 5 years, you can see this tremendous growth in the area. Now there's 25 warehouses across 5 kilometers area space. And if you look at the space today, it's crowded with people. We're hoping that the Creative Cities as a platform that can get the different cities to talk to each other, for the people in the city to know each other better, for better exchange, for more collaborations. Because I think that for Creative Cities to thrive, it's about collaborations.
I think the festival in the future is also the future of this area, you know, the Pier 2. We are began with 2 warehouses until now we have 25 and we are still growing. And that means that the people in Kaohsiung knows that in the future, especially in Asia, Taiwan must use the creative brain or the creative design power to lead in the future. So we are trying to find its way out.
Only time will tell whether Kaohsiung can build upon its recent developments. But the way in which the Design Festival and Pier 2 area currently act as microcosms for the whole city suggests that as long as residents maintain their interest in the work on display, then the city can continue to prosper. For Monocle in Kaohsiung, I'm Chris Fitch.
We'll be back after this short break to pay a visit to a certain studio in Spain.
More gritty than pretty Cape Town's reign as world design capital focuses on the problem-solving potential of design. As South Africa celebrates 20 years of independence, Monocle explores, in film, the city's design for social change agenda.
The death of Madiba has reminded us in many ways of our true transformation mission. And I think just seeing how the world mourned with us, revisiting what his early ambitions were, what his goals, what he stood for, gives us a sense of a mission. 20 years ago was just the starting line for us, and it's a marathon, it's not a sprint.
Live, design, transform life. Premiering in the film section of monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. We pay a visit now to one of Madrid's many winding narrow streets, specifically to the studio of the consummate designer Nicolas Pieper. The German-born Pieper set up shop in Spain many years ago and has since carved out a local niche for himself with his meticulous furniture and sculpture designs carefully crafted out of wood and metal. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldus paid a visit to his studio in the design-friendly Salesas district to explore the space and see what else he's been up to.
We run a showroom in the center of Madrid where we sell only our own design products, which are made by metal, different metals, cortin steel, stainless steel, and noble woods like elm wood, walnut wood, which are mostly recycled, found in old warehouses, closed carpenteries or factories. Well, our space is not that big. It's divided in 3 little rooms, spaces. We are situated in the very old part of Madrid. What we did is I want to have my space, the walls and all those, as clean as possible, so you don't see any reference that it's an old house, you know. From the outside, the facade is old, but the inside is just clean and white to highlight the pieces we produce. And it's also part of my philosophy, you know, mix old materials, natural material, with modern design. You know, it's a sort of organic mixture of sensuality, organic, at the same time clean. There's an influence from everywhere. A bit Bauhaus, a bit Japanese, and a bit forest and wild fields.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I prefer black music. I don't care whether it's jazz or rap or soul, funk, more classic, less classic, and so. But just for in the moment, my favorite is Johnny Guitar Watson.
Thinking about the first time I saw you, baby.
Yeah.
We fell in love so fast. Anyone could tell this kind of love has got to last.
And I like his voice because beside the written, the song, the voice itself tells a lot about his life. You can feel he has had a past, and it's not so electronic, it's natural, natural. It let you feel it. Here in the studio we have samples, just samples of what we do. And today you can see here like consoles, tables, lamps, wood basket because of the season especially. But they are just samples of what we are able to do. Our aim is that the people come here to ask for a unique piece. Well, the most outstanding project of this year was a fountain I had to design and to produce for an art collector in Mallorca. The fountain represents the leaves of lotus. It's an interplay between the natural leaves of the lotus and my fountain, because in summer, for example, the fountain is fully covered by the natural leaves. You can only hear the fountain, but you can't see it. It was a privilege for me to produce this. It was quite complicated work because the fountain is composed by 24 different leaves, and six of them, they have to direct the water to one leaf to another. So it was very complicated, but I think the result is spectacular. Most of the time I try to spend free in the fields. My inspiration is to be out of town, for example in my workshop, which is in the middle of nowhere, because I love space.
Nicholas Pieper giving Liam a tour of his studio, his work, and some music that inspires him. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Since its closure in 2008, Tempelhof Airport, to the south of Berlin's centre, has sparked countless debates as to what to do with its meandering runways, administrative offices, gargantuan hangars and green pastures. It's considered to be one of Europe's three iconic pre-World War II airports, and its main building is among the 20 largest buildings on Earth. In 2010, Tempelhof Feld was converted into a public park where Berliners enjoy everything from wind skating and barbecuing to concerts and urban gardening. The city of Berlin has new plans, however, to erect a central library along with apartment buildings in the park. The decision has outraged some residents who want to preserve the former airport as an open green space. Melanie Sevchenko headed to Tempelhof to hear both sides of the debate.
Standing in the midst of the former Tempelhof Airport, with its frozen ground, icy winds, and treeless horizon, it's difficult to understand what all the fuss is about. But come summer, its runways and fields will be alive with every warm weather sport imaginable. And that's exactly why residents in the surrounding neighborhoods want to save it.
People are really taking care of Tempelhof Feld because everyone, you know, has freedom to do what he wants, and there's no such restriction done by like well-minded planners.
Christoph Breit lives nearby Tempelhof Park. He's also the treasurer of 100% Tempelhof Feld, an initiative that grew out of the desire to protect the airport park. Yet long before barbecuing and sunbathing, It was used by the Allies to break the Soviet blockade of West Berlin, known as the Berlin Airlift, in 1948. Bright says the airport's monumental history helps their argument.
There's this iconic layer to Tempelhofer Feld, which makes it so special too, because it is so important for elder Western Berliners. With the Berlin Airlift, their lives were saved. So we really, really have supporters from that side, 80 years and older, who really say that it should be open just for that reason.
Towards the end of last year, the Berlin Senate launched a budget-busting plan to build a complex of apartment buildings and a new central library in the southwest corner of Tempelhof, adjacent to the airport's disused landing strip.
At this point in time, they say it will cost 270 million euros, but from experience, we know it will double or triple. They will say there's no alternative. Of course, this is like kind of strategy to start things with low figures, and then you need to put new money in to get it going.
A budget of 270 million euros is indeed a hefty figure. In 2012, the city faced major embarrassment when Berlin's new airport failed to open due to poor planning. 2 years later, and over 4 billion euros in debt, the city has not yet set a date when the airport will open. In the meantime, Berlin Mayor Klaus Wowereit and his Social Democrats have been up against harsh criticism, along with pressure upon Wowereit to resign.
Erstens alle in einem Boot, weil wir arbeiten jetzt seit vielen Jahren daran. 96 war der Konsensbeschluss.
To combat the city's building plans at Tempelhof Park, Christoph Bright and his peers at 100% Tempelhof Feld have embarked on a citywide campaign. They gathered over 185,000 valid signatures. 174,117 are needed to spark a referendum, equivalent to 7% of Berlin's electorate. The referendum is planned for spring.
From my feeling, it's like they did not really believe that we would be successful.
But over at Tempelhof, the building plans are in full swing. Regula Luscher is the Senate building director. On February 4th, she hosted an exhibition at Tempelhof to present the 40 proposals that competed for the new library design. Faced with the impending question of why a costly new project for the city, Luscher says the new library will embrace the one thing Berliners hold with the highest regard: public space for all.
In nowadays, libraries are something like a social machine of integration, and libraries are meeting points. Libraries are spaces where you can share your knowledge. That's the reason why it's so good that this library is on a park, on a huge public space where you have a lot of children, young people, older people, and that's the reason why it's so good to have the library and the park together.
Critics argue that not only will the library cost too much, but that its location at Tempelhof Park is not central, is poorly connected to public transportation, and is nowhere near academic institutes.
We didn't want to go to the academics areas. We really wanted to go to the people, to the normal people, which is very important.
According to Luscher, the Senate is supposed to stop their building plans until the referendum in spring. But she says they're going ahead regardless, in preparation. Among the numerous proposals for the new library, two were selected as potential designs. One comes from Klohmeier Oberst Architekten, based in Stuttgart. Jens Oberst says ultimately their design works with the needs of Berlin's diverse society. He feels there's no reason why both infrastructure and public space cannot coexist.
The idea says something about the philosophy of the project. It should be a place where you can make spontaneous happenings, where you can make an exhibition maybe. And this is something we found in architecture in the 60s and 70s, projects of Mendes da Rocha and Linda Bobardi in Brazil. The architects in that time thought official and public buildings should be in the context of the whole city. So they have not only spaces for the museums, they have spaces for the public too. And that's maybe an impulse of our design, and that's maybe the link to the Tempelhof-Feld discussions.
But Christoph Bright is having none of it. He suggests the existing building at Tempelhof Airport as a suitable location for the library. In fact, this building, amongst the largest in the world, remains primarily empty, occasionally used for trade shows and exhibitions. Alternatively, Berlin is full of buildings that could be renovated and refurbished, instead of building a completely new structure.
At the same time as the Senate plans to erect a completely new library, the decentral libraries in the districts, they are bleeding. They are closed down for allegedly not having enough visitors. We are really challenging the professional roles of these planning people, because they see this green field, Tempelhofer Feld, and they're thinking in terms of construction. They cannot really think of doing nothing. Of course, they make their living from that money, but as a citizen of Berlin, I don't understand why we should spend 60 million euros in creating a park where there's already an existing park that works perfectly well.
The referendum has been suggested for May 25th, the date of the European Parliament elections. If the majority votes yes for the library, the construction is set to start in 2016 and could take up to 5 years. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
We're not shy at Monocle about our admiration for London-based design maestro Oliver Spencer. Since setting up the brand in 2002, Ollie has built a reputation on creating wardrobes full of neatly tailored, well-detailed and good-looking garments. Starting off in menswear, he made the move into women's fashion in 2008 and now has 3 stores in London and 1 in Toronto. Monocle's very own Alexa Firminich caught up with Ollie to talk shop.
Well, I think like most fashion companies, it's ever-evolving. And that's our job. We're designing clothing. I design 4 collections a year. Every one of them looks completely different. I design separate collections for separate people. Say, Mr. Porter, I do 2 lines a year, especially just for them. I think it's very important that the brand moves on. When I started it, it was very much with the ethos of a very simple corduroy suit and a very simple moleskin suit. And that was literally, it was born out of that. And I come from a tailoring background as well. I have another business called Favorbrook, which is based on German Street, so that's tailoring-based. So this was really an offshoot from that, and that's how we started.
And what's the influence of British heritage in the brand?
I mean, the British heritage word is used a lot at the moment. Some people can justify the fact that they do it properly, and other people are just trying to jump on the bandwagon. I think that the heritage thing for me is always going to be a good thing. But I consider when I'm designing clothing that I'm 1 foot in the past and the rest of my body in the future. So it's very much we are looking ahead the whole time. And of course, all the best things are based from designs from the past and that are filtered through. Very seldom you get an actually brand spanking new product on the market that nobody's seen any influence at all from the past on. Electronics is probably the biggest area that happens.
In terms of innovation and keeping things fresh, where do you look for inspirations for new designs?
Well, the last 4 seasons I've been working off artists. So I started off, I think it's 3 years ago now. I was hugely influenced by Lucian Freud. So I did the year he died, I did a whole capsule collection for him, a wardrobe for Lucian Freud. And then from then on, I've used Ben Nicholson, I've used Joseph Beuys, and excuse my pronunciation because it's never correct, La Croix Voisie, but I keep getting pulled up on that one. And yeah, so I work towards artists and architecture.
How do you get that across to the people who wear your designs? Is it always apparent, or do they have to scratch a bit under the surface to get there?
No, it's quite apparent. Clean lines, big details, strong colours. You can read into a lot of things any way you want to read into something. But for me, in my mind, it's very apparent. Some of my customers, it's very apparent. Some of them, it's not. I don't really mind as long as they're enjoying the clothing. What we have developed, which is, I think, the most important thing about any brand, is that we have developed handwriting. and the handwriting's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And this is a message that we need to keep reinforcing.
Are there any new markets that you're looking to?
Sure, I'm just about to go on a, well, I'm doing a round the world trip. So I'm starting off in Tokyo, which is doing business there already. I'm going for some meetings in Hong Kong. So we're talking there at the moment. I'm then going down to Sydney. I'm going to Melbourne to look at retail down there and talk with the people who do business down there, InQ, which are, they're a great group of stores down there. And then I'm going over to LA. And LA, I'm just going to sit on Malibu Beach and get a suntan.
Well, actually, speaking about America and North America, you've recently broken into that market as well. You've opened two new stores.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, America is a different, a difficult spot to do business. They call it the graveyard of English business for many good reasons. It's a natural progression for us. So we're just treading very carefully over there. My attention is not necessarily focused at that market at the moment. My attention is focused at the UK. London right now is by far and away the capital for men's clothing. There's more interesting things going on. There's more diversity going on. Everyone right now is looking to the UK for clothing. And so I'm concentrating on my own home market. I'm also concentrating in Europe as well. France, I believe it's going to be a good market. And it's coming strong for our brand. It's already a very strong market, but it'd be good for our brand. Italy's working well for us, so we're going to get stuck in there.
Before I comment quickly on London, why do people say that the US is the graveyard for the fashion?
Oh, it's not just fashion. It's everything. Oh, God, it goes back a long, long way. It's not me that I didn't make that comment. It's an incredibly difficult market to do business in. New York, unfortunately, as far as my business is concerned, New York, unfortunately, has become a discount center. The rest of the U.S. is not as in bad a shape as New York. Doing business over there is just very tough. And I always call them the smiling assassins because they always come down and slap you on the back and say, have a nice day, give you a big, broad smile. And then you walk out the room and that's that. They do what they want. I'm also married to one, I'd like to point out.
And returning home, back here to London, this year's collections, the men's collections, the shows, what did you think of them?
I thought they were great. I think there's such a diversity going on right now. You've got everybody from Aggie and Sam and Katie Erie doing all that great stuff. They're innovators. They're doing interesting things. It's not all wearable, but it's interesting and good. And then you've got the more staple, mainstream, wearable clothing, which comes across from people like us, Burberry, Patrick Grant starting to do interesting stuff at the moment. Well, not starting, he's been doing it for a bit. He does good stuff. And there's so many people showing now over a 3-day period. It's all great. It's all great stuff.
That was Ollie Spencer talking to Alexa Firmanich. This is Section D and I'm Tom Morris. Coming up after the break, we'll be looking at Serbia's first ever design incubator.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Think of Serbian design, and perhaps the only thing that comes to mind is the old Yugo car. Perhaps not surprising after all the conflict and economic turmoil in the former Yugoslavia over the past 2 decades. But an initiative in Belgrade is trying to change that. Nova Iskra recently celebrated its first birthday as the region's first ever centre devoted to design research and development. It's aiming to give young designers a space to work, exchange ideas, and make connections with potential clients and mentors alike. It is, of course, housed in an achingly stylish concrete space near Belgrade's riverfront. And it comes complete with ambient music, espresso machines, and copies of Monocle in the library. Our correspondent Guy Delaunay went to meet one of the founders of Nova Iskra, Relia Bobic.
Hello.
Well, Nova Iskra is an initiative. First of all, it's a co-working space, but at the same time, it's a sort of an innovation platform dedicated to professionalization of young designers and creatives. And kind of our mission is to inject those of entrepreneurial spirit in the design sphere. So our main aim is actually to help young designers develop their professional careers and also to try to provide a meeting point and a kind of matchmaking point for designers and representatives of companies or manufacturers with the aim of course, developing new services, new products, and new high-quality projects that will be a result of a kind of multidisciplinary teamwork.
How much of a problem was it before for designers, particularly young designers, trying to get going?
Well, basically, to be a freelance designer in Belgrade or Serbia is pretty tough compared to capacities you would have, you know, if you lived somewhere else, maybe in some of the Western European countries. The first problem was that most of the people work from home. And they do most of their meetings in cafes. So it's a pretty unrepresentative kind of mode of working. And it also doesn't give you any chance of, you know, development, of growth. So one of the main things in our space and our activities is that we are providing these resources and capacities to the designers.
So you're talking about this matchmaking and inspiration that you're providing. What, if any, concrete results have you seen out of this?
Well, definitely there's been quite a few tangible results. So I can say there was at least between 15 and 25 small to medium design jobs that we managed to kind of matchmake between designers and the companies. And then all the programs that we have realized, they have gathered more than 4,000 people in our space in the first 12 months, because a lot of these programs are also open to the general public and to our professional community.
How much of this is a reflection of what's happened to Serbia in the past couple of decades? You've obviously used to have Belgrade was the capital of Yugoslavia, which had a great deal of capacity in terms of industry and design, but then you've had the conflict, international embargoes, economic woes. Where does that leave the design scene in this country now?
You don't have a real market that is, you know, functional and vibrant. The companies are mostly run by, I would say, conservative, you know, directors who don't see the value in design. And that is also something that Nova Iskra wants to work on, educating also these people coming from the industry side, not just from the creative side. And then with the education, we have a similar thing. You know, there hasn't been enough exchange with the I would say international, you know, design schools, and the capacities are very limited within our design-oriented universities. And the topics like design management and things which are increasingly important nowadays are actually missing, and also a lot of practical knowledge. So just going out to a factory and, you know, having contact with the materials and with the craftsmen and so on. So all of these things are some of the issues that we want to address through our education programs and through our innovation platform and the projects that we initiate there.
What would attract an international client to come to Serbia and to have the benefit of the design community here?
First of all, of course, the work is, and for some foreseeable time, is going to definitely be cheaper for somebody coming from abroad. And that's a kind of more an obvious reason. But the other really valuable reasons, I think, would be that people are very motivated to work here on good projects, and the clients which are available in Serbia, so to say, are very peculiar. So I think designers would be very excited to work with the kind of, you know, proper companies or businesses or startups coming from a more regulated, you know, kind of market area. So that's one thing. On the other hand, I think Serbian designers are very in line with all the modern current, you know, trends, like whether we talk about visual communications, industrial design or service development. But at the same time, they are not, they don't have this, you know, dictate that they have to really follow those trends. But they kind of, because there is a kind of distance between the main flow of the main market flow, I think the local creatives have this kind of space to take in all these influences and then kind of do something that is a combination of different experiences. And I think definitely, you know, the design scene every once in a while gets kind of saturated and, you know, trends kind of wear off and so on. So I'm sure in this regard there will be moments where I think the peculiar Balkan experience and aesthetics can be really, really interesting for clients coming from outside of Serbia and the region.
Relia Bobic of Nova Iskra in conversation with Guy Delaunay. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to have a word. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, in honour of our earlier report from Berlin's Tempelhof Airport, here's Jefferson Airplane with White Rabbit. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small. Mother gives you, don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10.